Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Plenty of big jewels on display at the Oscars last night. $3 million worth with emerald-cut earrings on Jessica Chastain. $2.5 million in platinum and diamonds on Jennifer Garner. But the jewels in the news lately are the ones on the run. $50 million worth or more in diamonds grabbed in a heist last week in Belgium. The latest in a long line of big heists. This hour on Point Inside the World of the Mega Heist. You can join the conversation. How do they do that? With all the security, all the glitter, how do they get away? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Brussels is James Fontanella Kahn, Brussels correspondent for the Financial Times. He's been reporting the story of last week's bold diamond heist from the airport tarmac in Brussels. James, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and hi to everyone.
Give us the mechanics, if you would, sir. What happened?
Well, that's the key question. I mean, it was indeed a pretty incredible coup, I'd say. So around 7:45 local time a week ago, eight men who were kind of masked and kind of quite heavily armed, and they were dressed up as policemen, they basically made a hole in the perimeter fence of the airport. And then they waited for a few minutes once they kind of had secured access to the runways and waited for a private security team that was carrying about 120 parcels of diamonds. They waited for this security team to load the diamonds on a plane that was on the tarmac, a Helvetica plane, so a Swiss owned a plane that was meant to go to Zurich, scheduled to leave, I think, at 8:05
p.m.
For Zurich, yeah, p.m. That's p.m. local time.
Yes.
in Europe. And so once they completed the loading, the eight robbers who were driving two vehicles, well, one was a Mercedes van and the other one was an Audi A6 car. They basically rushed on the runway towards the plane with blue flashing lights, which kind of resembled those of a kind of police vehicle. And once they reached the aircraft, they pulled out their guns and they didn't shoot anybody, but they pointed their guns towards the security guards, made their way and towards also two of the pilots of the aircraft, and they forced them to kind of open the safe on the cargo where the diamonds were being cached. And basically, in no time, they kind of took the load away, got back into their vehicles, rushed off, all this in kind of less than 15 minutes. The actual, you know, time spent for the snatch at the aircraft was probably, I mean, prosecutors are saying less than 5 minutes' time. I mean, this is, like, incredible. And they just rushed off in the night, in the darkness, and at the moment, we don't have a clue where the diamonds are and who's behind this.
Very heavily armed. These were not just handguns. These were assault rifles, machine gun style.
That's correct. Machine guns. And these machine guns had kind of, you know, laser sights. So this was kind of a mini military operation. I mean, some bad Navy SEAL kind of Belgian style.
You mentioned pilots. They weren't in on it. They were just doing their last walkabout check on the airplane when the thieves came roaring up, I guess.
Well, that's correct. We don't know who's involved. I mean, at the moment where the investigation is like they're looking for a mole because, frankly, it was all a bit too kind of well-orchestrated. It was a very kind of well-oiled operation. They didn't have any kind of hiccups, or at least we don't think they did. And so, I mean, at the moment, everybody's a suspect, really. But, that's where we are at the moment.
This was a passenger flight headed for Zurich. So they were down in the cargo hold. I guess it must regularly be used this way. Where were those diamonds headed? First to Zurich and then what? Beyond where?
Yeah, they were going to Surat in India, Western India, which is, so, I mean, Surat is the kind of one of the world's capital for small diamonds. I used to be based in India before moving to Brussels, so I kind of know the industry there quite well. And so all the world's smallest diamonds usually pass through Surat to get polished and cut, and then they're sent back to kind of global markets in the West, in particularly the U.S. And Europe. So that was their final destination. And just, I mean, just to get one thing clear, transporting diamonds on planes is usually considered the safest way to do the job because simply the security is usually extremely high. And the diamonds are just literally they're loaded onto the plane a few minutes before the flight is meant to take off. So it's usually a very tightly knit operation.
So we may all have flown with diamonds, more diamonds than we knew at some point. Of course, this airport, very important because it is only, 20, 30 miles away from Antwerp, the world capital of diamonds and diamond cutting.
You're right. I mean, Antwerp is by far the most important global center for diamonds. We're talking about at least this is what domestic traders tell us here in Belgium, but also in New York, they'll tell you the same kind of thing, is that 80% of the world's rough diamonds go through Antwerp, and about 50% of the polished diamonds are traded in Antwerp. So Brussels Airport is the closest airport, and I think there's various kinds of numbers, but apparently on a daily basis, you've got about $150 million worth of gems going through that airport. So $50 million loot is just, represents a third of what is a usual, normal business day for a diamond right. trader in the city.
How confident are you in that $50 million value for what was stolen? Immediately after the theft, we saw everything from $50 million, which the official spokesman for Antwerp's diamond center was saying, $50 million, all the way up to almost $470 million, half a billion.
Exactly. I mean, to be fair, we don't know. The security company involved, Bink, they would not reveal the value of the gems. But you can be I think the estimate given by the Antwerp World Diamond Center, which is a kind of an authority in this mm-hmm. field, mm-hmm. is probably a good estimate because they have a decent idea of what goes in and out in the business. So $50 million sounds reasonable. Let's say that.
Of course, they also have an interest in not being any more embarrassed than they have to be when something goes wrong in this spectacular kind of way. But point taken. James Fontanella Khan in Brussels for the Financial Times. You're very generous with your time, and we appreciate it. Thank you, James.
Thank you. Take care.
Let's go deeper here, try to really get inside the world of the heist. With me now from Los Angeles is Scott Andrew Selby, co-author of the book Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History, a look at the 2003 heist of more than $100 million in diamonds from the Diamond District in Antwerp. He wrote it with Greg Campbell, author of Blood Diamonds. Scott, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Who do you think took these diamonds?
That's a big question, perhaps a $50 million question. I definitely think it was a very organized group of thieves, and I think there's a very good chance that the police think that there's a mole. It's also possible that they just were planning this heist for a really long time. I would love to know who took these diamonds.
I mean, this is not... we'll talk about the heist that you describe, which was planned long, long time right in the heart of the Antwerp Diamond District. They went down into a vault underneath. Unbelievable planning and precision in how they got all the way in there, and it was done mainly with finesse. This had finesse, but it had a lot of just brute strength and armaments, firepower, mini military, you heard James say.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't specify. It's probably the F9P90, the Belgian police. These people in this current heist were dressed as Belgian police, so they may have been using the same firearms that the Belgian police used when they accompany these diamond runs. I've seen these diamond runs. It's it's very high security. Not only do you have the Brinks people, but you also have police with, like, armored stuff and these submachine guns. And it's a very different world than the heist that I wrote about that happened in 2003, where it was subterfuge, cleverness. Everybody, you know, comes down Monday morning and they're surprised that this vault has been robbed. And this is, you know, a bunch of guys quickly, you know, coming on more like a military operation and brandishing weapons. But on the other hand, these guys didn't end up hurting anybody. So it's possible that it could be a similar MO.
Why does Europe have all the big heists? Not all, but so many are happen in Europe, Scott. What's up with Europe? Why is it heist central?
Well, I guess it's like the old saying about banks. I mean, that's where the money is. That's where the thieves go. And Europe has a lot of the good things that people want. So that would be number one. Number two would be there's a lot more opportunity because there's so many different countries and jurisdictions, and it's possible to rob from one place and quickly cross the border into another. And so in some ways it is easier to pull off over there than it might be over here.
Scott Andrew Selby, co-author of Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. Please stand by in L.A. There's a lot more we want to learn here. This is On Point.
On days like these, I wonder what became of you. Maybe today you're singing songs with someone new. Questi giorni quando vieni il bel sole. La 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 la.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world of the heist. A little music behind us there from Thief, 1981. We heard On Days Like These from The Italian Job on the way out last time. And at the top, Booby Trappin' from Ocean's 11. We're looking in this hour at last week's big diamond heist in Brussels and beyond. Scott Andrew Selby is with us from Los Angeles, co-author of Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History, where he and his co-author look very closely at the 2003 theft heist right out of the heart of the Antwerp Diamond District. Of course, the Brussels airport, where this happened last week, serves that district. Scott, in L.A., we've got all kinds of questions and comments from listeners here. Mike on Facebook first asks, what does $50 million in diamonds even look like? Is it a little tiny pouch, Scott? Is it the briefcase size? What's $50 million look like in diamonds?
It all depends on exactly, you know, there's a lot of variation, but I'm going to say probably more around the shoebox areas, which you're looking at in this case.
So when they say 120 packets that were stolen, these were not big packets. This was 120 modest-sized packets, and you can put it under your arm and go.
Yeah, these packets are probably quite small, sealed envelopes, could be, you know, tissue-wrapped paper-based things. I mean, obviously there could be all sorts of, you know, wrapping and containing stuff like that, but if you were to strip all that down, you're looking more in the shoebox-type area. Perhaps with that stuff, it's more like a large duffel bag or something.
Now, here's a listener, Stuart, says, with art thefts, the heist is often easier than the sale of the stolen goods. And he asks, is this true with gem thefts, too, of this scale? And one of our listeners responds saying, yeah, it's hard to unload diamonds. They'll probably make less than $100,000 for that haul. It takes years to unload. Each stone has to be hidden among legitimate diamonds. I don't know what's true, what's not here, Scott, about unloading stolen diamonds.
It's actually, if you know what you're doing, and these guys probably do, it's quite easy. I mean, the listener might be right if it's somebody simply, you know, breaking into a car. Well, not going to find a diamond car, but breaking into somebody's house and they're going to a fence and whatever. But if you're a professional like these guys are, I'm sure they'll be able to unload everything. I wrote an article for Foreign Policy Magazine about that this week, and for the most part, it's pretty easy. The first person buying from you is going to have a lot of questions because they're going to wonder why an outsider is going to have these kinds of stones. But if you find somebody that you can do business with that's not going to ask any questions, you know, before you know it, it's going to be in four or five different hands within the day. It's just going to keep moving, and nobody's going to have any inkling that there's anything wrong with it. There's only very specific situations wherein you could trace back a stone.
I mean, I wondered about that. Are diamonds ID'd somehow? Is there something etched on them, or by their shape, can they be tracked down?
I mean, yes and no. Those are all the things you mentioned there, Tom, do happen, but those are not going to be your average stone. There's some stones that have little etchings on the girdle. Sometimes there's certain companies that do that for marketing purposes. Sometimes when you bring in a stone to a lab to be tested to get all kinds of information on it, normally they just seal it in a package, but sometimes they put a number on it. So that's possible. You also could have a very unusual stone, like color. You know, it's really big. It's got an unusual color. There's something special about it. That's possible, too. In the retail trade in America, sometimes people go to a company named there's a company that will do an optical fingerprint, and that's something that can be used. But it's not done at the wholesale level. So odds are there's probably only maybe a couple of stones amongst the ones they stole that they need to deal with.
You talked about this being probably outsiders looking to unload, but my listeners are very skeptical on that front. Drew in Georgia says, were these stones insured? And this is a mole, you know, LOL, laugh out loud, nothing better than getting paid two ways. Levi writes, this story has insurance scam written all over it. What about that dynamic? Could the owners themselves arrange the theft and then cash in?
I doubt it, because I don't think that the owners wouldn't know the details of security at the airport. I mean, that's where you need the insider information. All the owners would know is that, hey, some diamonds are going to be picked up today at 2. You know what I mean? And anybody could know that. You could just walk along and see that with your own two eyes. So I don't really see how that helps. These diamonds in this case were insured. There were rumors and talks about certain similar things with the book, The Heist, I wrote about in 2003, that I wrote about in Flawless. But it turned out that very few of the people actually had insurance in that case. Here, all these things will be insured, and I mean, it's possible, but I'm thinking when the police are talking about insider, they're talking about insider that have useful information. So that means somebody that, you know, maybe at Brinks or at the airport security, something like that, where you would know exactly, you know, which point, that there was this moment of opportunity, that you would know, you know, how to get the diamonds quickly out of the airport, that sort of thing.
Your investigation of the big theft in 2003 went back to Turin in Italy. And a gang of jewel thieves there who very carefully set this up. They pretended that they wanted to, and they did, rent a space in the Diamond Center, in the building that they ultimately burgled on a massive scale. You described this opening scene where the police show up the next morning having had no idea, and there are just leftover jewels bouncing around on the vault floor. What about this kind of theft? Does it have Turin, Italian, any kind of fingerprint on it that would suggest a particular origin for the thieves?
That's an excellent question, Tom. A lot of people are talking about it perhaps being the School of Turin. The School of Turin is loosely affiliated professional criminals who are experts at what they do, and you just put them together for an individual heist. So, for instance, the heist that I wrote about in Flawless, there's a guy who was perfect with keys, there's a guy who knows alarms, there's a guy who's the inside man who robs, you know, who sets up an office, there's a guy who's muscle, you know, there's all kinds of different skill sets that are brought in just for one particular job. And so it's possible that something like that could happen here. Normally the School of Turin is known for being very clever and not using violence, but on the other hand, in this particular heist that just happened, nobody was injured. So it's quite possible it could be them. And there's a lot of weird coincidences. There's an article on the Daily Beast this week about that, about all the coincidences that are shared between the heist that I wrote about in 2003 and the current one, including the fact that the main guy from the heist in 2003, the inside man, is now back in jail in Belgium right around the timing of this. And it's entirely possible. I mean, maybe these guys even noticed these diamond trucks, Brinks, going back and forth to the airport and sort of thought about some opportunity and some way to take advantage of. And it very well could be the School of Turin. Or it could be another gang that's known as the Pink Panthers that are based in Eastern Europe. Or it could be some other group that we've never even heard of.
We've got listeners here. AC says, you know, thanks a lot for giving terrorists a new idea, diamond thieves. That is, don't mess around with airport security. Just blast right through the fence onto the tarmac, and you're in the thick of it. Let's get a call here from Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, what an interesting subject.
Oh, good.
I'm not a criminologist, but I am interested in organized crime. I've read a lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just stay with Massachusetts. The first biggie was the Brinks job, okay?
Sure, famous.
It happened back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It was big for that time. And then there was another break-in in a bank in Medford during a holiday where they burrowed through the roof and got in there. But how about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum with the cop uniforms? I believe that these jobs have a foreknowledge about what the products are going to be. There was the big train robbery in England years ago.
Sure.
Now there's this massive bunch of stones near Antwerp. Why didn't the people that owned the stones that hired their security guards to bring the stones to the plane pay them to accompany them on the plane fully armed? There's a lot of questions that are unanswered here, but it ain't nothing new. And sophisticated high-end heists are well-planned. I saw a movie from many years ago called Rafifi. It's about this kind of stuff. So it's an interesting observation. I have no answers, but it's quite interesting.
Harold, let us pick it up right there. We're going to look before this hour is over at how something like this last week goes from heist to so often. You're right. We've seen it again and again. It ends up on the big screen in Hollywood. We'll look at how that happens. But, Scott, what about it? I mean, first of all, surely these were armed guards with this $50 million in diamonds, were they not? What I'm reading here is that they were just cowed by the eight guys with, they said, Kalashnikov-style rifles that nobody wanted a bloodbath, and so they let them take them.
It sounds like there just was this moment when things were being transferred onto the plane that everybody's security was sort of, everybody's guard was down, so to speak. And I think the question about why they didn't have security accompany the diamonds on the plane is a good one, but I think...
Are you sure they did not?
That's a good question.
I'm reading here, you know, that the thieves said, look, you know, just stand aside or die, and they did. Stand aside.
Yeah. I mean, but they must have caught them in an off moment. I'm sure if you attacked a Brinks truck while it was in motion, it'd be a very different story, or while it was accompanied by the armed police that accompany these transfers. I think what it is there definitely is an element of the fact that they busted in at an airport where everybody thought it was very secure.
Well, and just at that moment where they're going from the Brinks vehicle to the belly of the plane.
Exactly. And because of all the security that surrounds airports with terrorist sort of stuff, people assume that it's very safe to transport things that way, and the insurance rates are very low that way. I mean, it's considered the safest way, it's the safest way to transfer things. And so this sort of just points out a real opening in security. And somebody else, a commentator, mentioned the issues of terrorism, and I think it's a huge issue. And I think we really need to do more to make sure that the perimeters are secure around airports in the first world, and also in the United States.
We'll look at that piece. That is an eye-opener in this case. Bill is calling from Springfield. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of chime in, and I think people have a misconception about it. I know several individuals, and I kind of used to be one myself, who kind of pull heists and certain things, you know, of that nature. And these are people who maybe started out shoplifting and they were looking for something more.
I should say so. $50 million, $500 million, that's more.
Well, you know, I think people think that, you know, they're taking like an Ocean 11's approach, that these guys are all super professionals. I mean, the fellas that I know, maybe they'll work in a job or something like that, and they'll notice, hey, there's a lot of something moving here, or there's something important here, and they'll tell some of their friends, and then it starts being created. A lot of people think that these are all criminals, that this is an organization, this is what they do.
Yeah.
Really, a lot of it is just friends putting together somebody that knows something.
Well, now, but you're talking there about maybe a heist, yeah, but maybe not at the multi-million-dollar diamond level. But maybe you are, Bill. Or is it you're talking about, like, let's grab some, you know, product off the back of a truck?
Well, there is some of that. That's true. But, I mean, I know a couple fellas that have done ATM heists and such like that. Maybe it's still not in the million-dollar level. But you know, I don't think people realize that there is a huge network of people out there that do have these special skills, and they are put together.
And they're willing to do it, and looking, and watching, and maybe waiting for the opportunity. I appreciate your call, Bill. Scott, what are you thinking as you hear that? How much opportunistic sort of, hey, there's some diamonds, let's go get them, and how much maybe real professional background to this heist?
And that was a really good point, and it varies widely. There's all kinds of different stories, you know, with all kinds of different heists. I mean, there's a famous Lufthansa heist in America that's turned into Goodfellas, where it was really low-level organized crime that kind of stumbled into something much bigger than they expected. And with this, anything's possible, but I think that it takes a lot of experience and a lot of training to pinpoint the moment when there's a vulnerability and to be brave enough to say, you know, go on to an airport tarmac and to do all this without panicking and actually hurting somebody. I mean, there's nothing here to suggest that these guys are amateurs or that these guys are just starting off. And traditionally, diamond heists have been done by people that have had to spend a lot of time thinking about how to get around security and how to make something happen. I mean, traditionally, they are amongst, you know, the hardest kinds of heists to pull off.
And if this was indeed, if it was $50 million, you've got a list of the biggest jewel heists in history, at least when your book came out not that long ago. And this would rank right up there in the top five if it's 50. And if it's bigger, you know, you get up to the top of that list in a hurry. This is a pretty big one.
It's definitely a big one, and it's definitely impressive in terms of how the military precision with how quick they were in and how quick they were out. But, I mean, it is true that you don't need to be, Ocean's 11 to be able to pull that off, but it definitely does take a certain level of discipline and experience to be able to just quickly move in and quickly move out.
Stu
and not be sidetracked. Yeah.
Let's get a call from Stu in Norwood, Massachusetts. Stu, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Actually, last week, I'm in the jewelry business, mm-hmm. and I was at a conference last week when this whole thing happened, and one of my Antwerp diamond dealers went into apoplexy, wondering if any of his goods were part of this heist.
Oh, boy. Really? What did he think about it?
Well, he was one of the guys who got burned in the Antwerp thing, and Antwerp, as your guest probably knows now, for a vehicle to get into the Diamond District in Antwerp is virtually impossible without 96 different forms of security.
Right.
And, you know, it's like you can't replace it. And again, as your guest says, unless there was something really special about some of the diamonds that were taken, pros are going to have these things. They're probably already in the market.
I mean, that means
I could own one next week and not even know it.
So that sounds, I mean, you're in the business and it looks to you like it's not actually very hard to unload them.
I wouldn't, you know, professionals, I don't think it'd be real hard to unload them at all.
And would they get more or less market price? Would they have to sell them at a steep discount? How do you think that would go, Stu?
I'm guessing depending on how quickly they wanted to divide it up. You know, if they wanted to lump sum it, then they'd probably get significantly below market price. If they wanted to parcel it out in different parts of the world, you know, take it to Hong Kong, take it to Japan,
yeah,
take it to Dubai, and, you know, 50 carats here, 100 carats there, they could probably get more.
Wow. Do you see it as a more heist territory in Europe, Stu? You're looking from this side of the pond. Is it more dangerous over there on the theft front for jewels?
I think it's dangerous everywhere.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, it's something, low economy, you know, it's something that's always in the back of my mind.
Absolutely. Stu, be safe and good luck, and thanks for calling. Scott Andrew Selby, co-author of Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. Please stand by there in Los Angeles. We're looking at the big one last week at the airport, right off the tarmac in Brussels. 5 minutes, $50 million, and gone. A little theme from the first great train robbery right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook. This is On Point. Little music there, quick exit from the Thomas Crown Affair, art heist in that case. We're talking this hour about the world of the heist, last week's big diamond heist in Brussels and beyond. Scott Andrew Selby is with us from Los Angeles today. He has gone very deep on the whole world of, well, blood diamonds and diamond theft. Flawless Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History is his book, and he joins us from L.A. You can join us as well. Did you see the news of last week's big heist? What did that leave you thinking? Can you imagine how it's really done, planned, researched, pulled off? Lots of fascination with these. It's made a lot of Hollywood movies. In a moment, we're going to talk with Brian Koppelman, who was a screenwriter for Ocean's 13, about how so many of these have gone from news report to the big screen, how he would take this one if he wanted to get it up on the screen and make it into Hollywood material. Scott, we've got all kinds of response from our listeners on the air. Dave says, I won't be the only one to say it's kind of exciting, thinking of the heist last week. I think people love to see vulnerability in the powerful and wealthy. I guess that's part of what draws people into the movie theaters. Seth on Twitter says, an even bigger heist was the 4 hours of life stolen from millions by the Oscars last night. Seth MacFarlane, when he went to that Lincoln joke, he lost me right there, but put that aside. Mad Mark says $50 million is a pittance. Our financial engineers on Wall Street make these guys look like amateurs. And then Ian, and this is interesting. He says, you know, there are thousands of out-of-work people who are extremely skilled at assault coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. These guys have a true expertise. Regular police and security don't stand a chance. You can expect to see a whole lot more of these sorts of heists well into the future. What about that mini-military, James Fontanella Khan described this? What about that aspect, Scott? Is that nude? Eight guys, you know, all very heavily armed. It's almost as much a military maneuver as a sophisticated heist here. Certainly, this is not old-style Pink Panther.
That's, There is a new style gang called the Pink Panthers that do certain heists that are quite like this, that have
out of the Balkans, security. I think I read.
Correct. They're generally out of Eastern Europe. It's a group of different people. And your listener who had the point about these people coming out of the military and not being able to get employment and then getting into crime and being organized is a wonderful comment. It's going to be a definite problem. I wrote another book called The Axeman Conspiracy, The Nazi Plan for a Fourth Reich and How the U.S. Army Defeated It. Mm-hmm. And it talks about when the U.S. occupied Germany, and the same thing happened where there were, you know, Germans who had fought in the war and had experience and now couldn't work and there was crime. And so you always, after a war and with bad employment, there are possibilities. And it is possible that these guys have some sort of military background or police military-like training, like, say, SWAT training or something, because you definitely need some sort of experience in life to be able to, you know, just bulldoze your way onto a tarmac and calmly do something like this and get out again and just time it so quickly, too, to be in and out in such a set amount of time. It definitely seems like something that people with military experience might have done.
They had maybe a five-minute window, it would appear, when those diamonds were out of the Brinks truck and being transferred on into the cargo hold of the plane. That's precision. How do you imagine they knew when to go through that fence, when to go lights blazing onto the tarmac? Does that mean they'd have to have somebody out there with a walkie-talkie saying, you know, go, or they just got great infrared nighttime binoculars and they're watching? What do you think?
I have two theories. I mean, in this, your question really gets to the heart of the matter, and I think this is something that the detectives in Belgium are going to be looking into. And one possibility is they have somebody on the inside that's already told them everything, that's already said, hey, from, you know, 1202 to 1207, this happens, and then that happens, and they have all the information that they need from some inside source. The other possibility that I see, or the other main possibility that I see, is one of observation. So like you said, they could have been watching these diamond runs. They could be off, you know, by the side of the airport somewhere with some sort of, you know, optical lenses, you know, and looking at this and watching this, as he said, and seeing this. And maybe they've observed it 20 times before, and they know, hey, the moment that this happens, you know, from the moment that the pilot comes out to check on the plane, we have exactly 7 minutes, or, you know, they could have some sort of way to know this information. So either they observed it and learned it themselves, or they have an inside source. And so the question that's going to be the first thing the police are going to look at is this the sort of thing that they need an insider for, like the old Lufthansa heist that happened in America, or is this like the heist I wrote about in Flawless in 2003, where somebody could sort of have planted themselves somewhere near things and just observed for a long time?
Dan in Saratoga Springs, New York. Dan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm just kind of going back to the point we were talking about. You say you don't see like a lot of heists like this in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I would think a lot of that would be due to proximity of different nations. You know, even traveling across basic domestic borders within the United States, there's interagency problems. So can you imagine traveling, you know, in 2.5 hours, you can go from Antwerp to Luxembourg fairly easily.
Sure, and right on.
Yeah,
yeah.
Directly through, you know, Tom? So it's,
yeah, no,
it makes common sense. I've been in the military, I've been in the police, I've been overseas, and I could see, you know, if I was going to plan something along those lines, you know, you had a good point with observation versus a mole.
Mm-hmm.
Both, maybe a little bit of both, you know.
And then off you go into that warren of European boundaries where you might travel more easily sometimes than law enforcement. Appreciate your call, Dan. Scott, how about that? I mean, you say there's different jurisdictions. They're very close by. That's part of what makes the getaway easier, an extradition tricky.
Yeah, your caller was spot on. And it's an interesting contradiction because in Europe they want to be open. They have this European Union. There's free movement of people and goods. When you're crossing borders there in Western Europe, there's going to be pretty much nothing. And the only big exception being Switzerland. But basically just leave Switzerland out of it. You go to any of these other places and you're just cruising along, but law enforcement isn't up to that same level of cooperation. Like, there's going to have different databases, there's different rules about extradition. I mean, maybe even if they want you and they try to extradite you, they could have problems. You know, maybe one country knows that you have a long criminal history, but the other country has no idea.
Mm-hmm.
You're not even in their system, you know, or in their radar. I mean, they're working on cooperation, but it's a real issue for law enforcement over there, and it came... The case I wrote about in Flawless, that happened all the time because the thieves were from Italy. And, you know, and so other countries were involved in this stuff. One of the guys got extradited from Portugal, one guy from France recently. It gets really confusing. And the thieves, okay, the police in Turin, in Italy, they know all about these guys. They could tell you their life stories. They could tell you all the stuff that they think they've been up to. But, you know, you move a few countries over, they show up. Nobody has any idea who these guys are.
Yeah. Hey, Scott, as we're speaking, Pursuit magazine is tweeting about this conversation. They must be monitoring our... They say, great discussion of Brussels diamond mega heist at On Point Radio. They say, how would you investigate this? I guess they're asking their Pursuit magazine, maybe these are professional pursuers. I'll put it to you, Scott. How do you go after this? They're you know, they found, what, a burnt-out vehicle not far away, and the rest has vanished in the night. How do you begin to track this down?
I think what I would concentrate on is trying to figure out whether this was a mole or whether it just was observation. Either way, you're gonna learn something. You know, if it was observation, maybe somebody noticed a van by the side of the road 2 weeks ago acting suspiciously and somebody watching this, you know. So that would be one way to get clues. I try pursuing a few things, find out if there's anything special about any of these diamonds that might allow us to recognize them somehow, put word out and with the criminal underworld, just, you know, see if there's any rumors.
Sounds like it could be a long haul. Sounds like it could be a very, very long haul. Scott Andrew Selby is co-author of Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. That's quite a story in itself. I recommend it. Joined us today from Los Angeles. Scott, thank you so much for your insights this hour. It's been great having you.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Hollywood has for a long time loved a good heist. Diamond heist? Sure. Here's a little bit from the 2007 film Ocean's 13. Remember the teams trying to steal 4 diamond necklaces from a Las Vegas hotel by replacing them with a set of fakes? Here's Rusty, played by Brad Pitt, Linus, played by Matt Damon, Terry, played by Andy Garcia, Basher, played by Don Cheadle, trying to figure out how to get into the diamonds display case.
Look, we're talking about a secure room, Terry. This isn't just a glass box these diamonds are housed in. This is 2-inch thick concussion-proof glass.
Wired with pressure-sensitive 7-digit coded alarms.
Kill the power to the hotel. It's worked for you before.
No. See, the case and the alarm both have independent power supply. I mean, and besides, you don't run the same gag twice. You do the next gag.
The Ocean's guys sitting around trying to figure out how to get at those diamonds. Let's think for a minute about this heist last week and how heist stories end up on the big screen, how this one might get to the big screen. Brian Koppelman is with us, joins us from New York, screenwriter for Ocean's 13, also on Runner, Runner, Solitary Man, Tilt, Runaway Jury, Rounders. He has worked on all kinds of films in Hollywood. Brian Koppelman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, great to be here.
So you saw the news last week. I don't know if you gave it a second thought, but if you put your mind to it, is this still grist for a movie, or is our viewing audiences over heist stories?
Well, you know, it's all cyclical, and I mean, if you look at it, heist movies have long been a staple of cinema because they have these great elements. As you know, we're all fascinated with the outlaw.
Sure.
Maybe it's part of Manifest Destiny. Americans in particular, we love the idea that we can pull something off, that we can get away with something great, that we can be more dramatic or more romantic than we perhaps really are.
Yeah.
And so heist movies give you all of that. It lets you be a criminal, often though not a really violent criminal, and a criminal who can outsmart and outwit people. And I think for that reason, if you find a great one, one that's great technically, meaning the criminals found a new way to do something like they did here, or worked as a team that was particularly tight and unique. But more than that, if you can then find or invent the reason these particular guys had to do this at this particular time. And if that's really compelling, sure, this is totally something that could be grist for the heist movie mill.
Of course, this is not all suave fare perhaps this time. I don't know. Is this more Clooney or more Vin Diesel, this one, Brian?
Well, that's funny. Well, there's no reason it couldn't be. I mean, either one of those, right? That goes back to whatever the tone that the filmmaker is looking
mm-hmm,
to do.
Mm-hmm.
This reminded me of the movie Heist, David Mamet's film from, I guess, 2003, which took place on a runway also.
Yep.
It was non-violent. In the end, nobody got killed. And, I mean, that's a terrific heist movie. I don't know if your audience has seen it, but for me, that was a team that functioned in a very militaristic manner. It was a team... It seemed very believable. They used both social engineering, technical know-how to get that heist done.
So if you sat back and said, you know what, I see a way to make this compelling. Yes, we've had the great train robbery and everything else for decades and decades, but I see a way to get this done. Give us a little shop talk here. How would you begin to try and push this forward if you wanted to make it into a movie, Brian?
Well, there are a few different angles of attack. If you're asking about what the sort of way that you would conduct the business of this, one, you would change it slightly. You could say based on. If you say it's based on events that happened
mm-hmm.
or inspired on events that happened, let's say, then you could really make the thing up and use whatever you wanted to use from it without having to acquire any underlying rights.
Right.
And
I should point out, we had Scott on earlier, the chief thief in that inside the Antwerp Diamond District heist that he wrote about, J.J. Abrams actually bought his personal life story, but you wouldn't have to. I don't think it's ever become a movie. You wouldn't have to do that. Base it and take some dramatic license, and off you go.
Sure, you can totally do that, and then you do. You do research. If you do this properly, you go and you set it up at a studio. You tell them the story. You enlist them in your vision of it, and then you do a bunch of research. I mean, you played that clip from Ocean's 13,
mm-hmm.
and even though that movie is light and fun, as much a comedy as it is a heist film. We spent, my partner, David Levine, who I write the movies with,
yeah.
he and I went to Vegas for weeks and studied with all the different security people at the casinos.
That must have been rough.
And went into the count rooms and really tried to figure out how would somebody be able to penetrate this. And then you look and you study the history of cons and the history of heists, and you try to just apply stuff that's worked in the past. And then, you try to do sleight of hand so that the viewer doesn't see where you're fudging it a little bit to make it more entertaining.
How does the business side get going? Where would your first call go here? I don't know, name or type, but, who do you, what door do you knock on to say, what do you think? Here's the angle I'd take on this.
Well, that's a great question. One of a few different ways. If there's a particular movie star that you see for some reason in it, if it just
mm-hmm.
made sense to you,
mm-hmm.
and if you had a relationship with that movie star, perhaps you'd call that person. Or you would call a producer who you felt had made movies that were either in a similar terrain, or the producer who had relationship with the right movie star, and then you would go and try to send them the email and maybe send them this radio broadcast and say, look, this is a big story, someone's going to take it, and let's try to make a film out of it.
Is there some way that you can sort of claim it and say this is ours, or could two parties be going after the same story based on at the same time?
Well, that sometimes happens. You know, sometimes you will get studios and neither one will blink and other people will be trying to make it. But often, if you surround yourself with the right people, an announcement would come out or be leaked that said, oh, these people are all working on this movie, and that might make other people stand down. And then the other way is to go acquire rights. So you would go to some of the people who got ripped off. You would go to the airline, and maybe you would try to buy the rights from them. And then you could say, hey, you know, this is our terrain.
Boy, turn it inside out. Scott there talking about this new group that's actually called Pink Panthers, but they're actually sort of heavy military guys out of Eastern Europe. I mean, you could take some of the old tropes and turn them inside out to maybe to find something new here, Brian.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah, you definitely could. And that's, I mean, you know, you look at these things. This one seems, I wouldn't be surprised if someone did this. I mean, you can look at, there are some movies you don't even realize are based on stuff like that great De Niro, Pacino, Michael Mann movie, Heat. That was a story Michael Mann had been trying to tell for 10 years, ever since he'd heard about a specific cop and a specific criminal, and he changed it a lot over the years. The story evolved, but he was fascinated by that kind of a daylight armed heist of a bank that was also, like this one was, militaristic in its approach.
Well, who knows? Maybe somebody's working on it right now. Maybe you, Brian Koppelman, will start typing something out tonight. Who knows? We'll see. Brian Koppelman, screenwriter for Ocean's 13. Brian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Listeners, great to have you with us. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk with Duncan Wall. He ran away to join the circus, found that circus life has really changed. Check it out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.